Thank you, Valerie, for that very generous and warm introduction. I'm really delighted to be back with you again. It really feels like a kind of Dharma home for me. Let me just check. Can everyone see and hear me okay? Is everything all right there?
Yeah, it looks and sounds great.
Great, good. last time I was with you, that time in person, I gave a talk about stories. I offered a story about stories. And I think the main point is one that, because of our practice, we're mostly familiar with, you know, this realization that, you know, so often people think that we are experiencing the world as it is, but we're actually perceiving it through a filter of our stories about it. And that also applies to ourselves, that we so often understand who we are through a filter of stories about, you know, who we should be, who we want to be, et cetera, et cetera. For me, one of the really, maybe the most interesting and important question about that talk was, in our practice, is our goal to find the true story, the correct story? Maybe for Theravada Buddhism, that would be the Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, something like that. In Zen, is our path about sort of plugging everything, especially koans, into a story about essential nature and phenomenal nature, form and emptiness? Or is our path about getting rid of all stories, which is what, you know, you could say what that's what we're doing when we're meditating, right? Although that's a kind of interesting story in itself, isn't it? A very peculiar story, a story that we should get rid of all stories. Or is our path about understanding how storying works and sort of holding them more lightly? Because we also need stories, right? Stories teach us what the world is, how to live in it. So that's what I talked about last time. And what I'd like to offer today is a story that I've been working on for some years now. And I'm hopefully toward the end of a book where I sort of present it. It's a rather complex story. So, you know, the best I can do this evening is sort of hit some of the high points and try to give you a sort of an overview. It's going to be a little different than the usual kind of Dharma talk, and it may seem rather sort of abstract, maybe a bit too intellectual, and you may not see the connection between, you know, your own path and what this story is going out about. But for me, it's very important because it tries to understand the context of Buddhism, the Buddhist path, and really what we're doing. It tries to put that in a kind of historical perspective that also helps us understand the particular kind of crisis that we're in today. And that's where I want to start, actually. You could say the mess that we're in today. If you've heard another talk by me, you might have heard me refer to something Noam Chomsky said a few years ago, that right now is the most dangerous time in human history. I think he's right. And I think, in fact, it's even more dangerous than he talked about. For example, he talked about the climate crisis, but that's just the tip of a much larger crisis, isn't it? A much larger ecological crisis, including extinction event, so many plant and animal species disappearing, forests, topsoil disappearing, poisonous toxins in the air, the earth, and the water in our bodies, etc., etc. But it's much bigger than that. I mean, Chomsky also talks about the danger of nuclear war, which seems a lot more scary after the Russian invasion of Ukraine. He also talked about the decline of democracy, the fact that even in many nominally democratic countries, there's a resurgence of authoritarianism. And we could go on and on. I mean, there's a lot of things he didn't talk about. For example, it seems like right now, according to some people, we have the greatest gap, the greatest difference between rich and poor. That, you know, the top 1%. One version of this, and I'm not sure it's completely right, but it does give us some sense of how bad things are. Some people have said, I have read, that the top 1% in the world own about 50% of its wealth. And the bottom 50%, close to 4 billion people, that bottom 4% are so poor that they don't own much more than 1%. I'm not sure that's true. Maybe it's an exaggeration, but still it's pointing at something truly horrific, even if it's not literally true. So what's often happening now is we have people talking about the poly crisis, right? It's not just one crisis. We have a number of crises. But in fact, I prefer to use, or I guess this is my question, is it a poly crisis in the sense that we just happen to have a bunch of really dangerous things going on at the same time? Or can we call it a meta crisis, meta in the sense of higher? Is it possible that the various crises that are going on now are actually expressions of some greater problem, right? Maybe expressions of some problem with our basic human nature. And if so, what role might religion have been playing in affecting that? And maybe what role might different religions play in maybe helping to resolve that, helping to heal that problem? So that's the kind of context. We're in a dangerous situation, no question. The world that I grew up in, it seems to me, frankly, it's falling apart pretty quickly. And it's really important for me, at least, to try to understand what the heck is really going on here. I'd like to start that inquiry by returning to a really important basic Buddhist teaching, which is, I think, something we're all familiar with. It needs to be contrasted with the focus in the Abrahamic traditions like Judaism, Christianity, Islam. There you could say the fundamental issue is the duality of good versus evil. That's the problem, right? It's about will. Are we doing what God wants us to and so forth? That's not the Buddhist approach. That's not the fundamental issue for Buddhism. For Buddhism, it's more cognitive, if you will. It's more about wisdom versus delusion, or ignorance versus awakening. But also that fundamental duality, if you were, it does manifest itself in the world in three ways, which is the three poisons, sometimes also known as the three fires. And frankly, personally, I find this very, very helpful, right? The three poisons, which can be translated as greed, ill will, including aggression, and delusion, right? Those are the three poisons. And frankly, I think that perspective explains and helps a lot. Traditionally, Buddhism can be understood as helping us transform individually, right? Our greed into generosity, our ill will into loving kindness, our delusion into wisdom, especially wisdom that sees the delusion of a separate self. One of the things that I've talked about and written about is the idea that actually today we need to understand them not just individually, but collectively, institutionally, that they have been institutionalized. For example, I think if greed means you never have enough, then I think that's a pretty good description of our economic system. You know, corporations are never profitable enough. Consumers always want to consume more, et cetera, et cetera. Ill will, you know, we can see lots of issues there. Racism is obviously a very big one. Our attitude toward, you know, refugees, other, and of course, I think a lot of it applies to the nation state system, but we don't have time to really go into that too much. Also, collective delusion, not only things like advertising and the way that manipulates our cravings, but also fake news, which I think we've all become very familiar with in the last few years, Fox News and so forth. So I think that's something important to see, the how the three poisons have been institutionalized and therefore how we have to find ways to work together to address them. But I also want to say, well, wait a minute here. Can we go back the other direction? We have these three poisons. Where do they come from? How do they originate? Why do we have this problem? This is something that the Buddha himself didn't want to go into. You know, he didn't want to talk about things like the origin of karma and delusion. He tended to see it as a distraction. The important thing is that he offered a path to resolve them, and that's what he wanted people to focus on. But to be quite frank, I think with contemporary theories like evolution, which is more than a theory, I mean, it's like, it's kind of the ground of modern biology. I think that can be very helpful in helping us understand the origin of the three poisons, especially when we look at, when we consider that evolution doesn't just apply to our bodies, but, you know, does it apply to our minds, right? What do I mean by that? Well, let me back up a bit just to remind us what evolution is, right? That when species reproduce, you know, usually the offspring aren't exactly the same as their parents. There's going to be some genetic variation leads to what's called selection, right? So if there's more offspring than can survive, some are maybe going to have some advantage. Like, right, if you're a giraffe and you happen to be a little bit taller than your siblings, that could give you a very big advantage in the struggle to survive and thrive and reproduce. Reproduction, of course, is the big issue. It doesn't matter what genes you have or don't have if you don't reproduce, because your genes will die with you. The important thing about evolution is that the only thing that matters in the long run is what genes survive, and they survive by getting into the next generation. It's not about intentions, despite Dawkins and selfish genes and all that. Genes don't have intentions. But here's the big question. Have the three poisons, greed, ill will, delusion, have they originated and survived because they sometimes helped individuals reproduce successfully? They aided in what's called selection, right? You see, we know, for example, that consider our bodies. We know our bodies evolved, and we know that we evolved from a species that had four legs, but at a certain point we stood upright, and we can see, well, actually this has a lot to do with the fact that many of us suffer from lower back problems, that the spinal system evolved for a four-legged animal, and of course it's had to adapt to standing up, but that means there's a kind of a weakness or a propensity, right? But we also have to ask, well, is it only something that affects our bodies? What about our brains, right? What about the way the brain evolved? And, you know, so when I'm talking about, you know, these tendencies, genetic tendencies, I think it's because I think we need to accept that evolution also works in the way that our brains function and the way, the kind of propensities that we have there. Maybe we don't like to think about that, but that's a part of us, a certain kind of self-centeredness or selfishness, right? But what's interesting is that that's not the only thing. In addition to individual selection, there's also what is called group selection. And in fact, that's something that Darwin himself talked about. Because it's not simply that within a group, individuals are competing to get their genes into the next generation, successfully competing with each other, but also you have more than one group often competing for the same resources. And so there's that competition as well. And as Darwin said, he also pointed this out. He said, if you have a group where it's simply a bunch of selfish individuals who are only looking out for themselves, and if they are fighting, if they're in competition, maybe warring with another group that are able to be more altruistic, more self-sacrificing in the sense that they're willing to work more together, to risk themselves if necessary in order to prevail. Well, Darwin said, which group is going to survive? Which group is going to be successful? So what I'm trying to point at here is there's something really interesting going on. The way that evolution works, it doesn't mean that one predisposition is going to replace an earlier predisposition. What I'm suggesting, and I think this is not so far-fetched in evolutionary theory, is that we have built within us a kind of a tension between more self-centered tendencies, you know, what's in it for me, and more altruistic tendencies, what's going to work for the benefit of the group. And the really interesting question or thought for me is this the origin of our preoccupation really deep within us, I think, between, you know, good versus evil? Does this help explain why we are so preoccupied with them? Now, that's not to say that group altruism, you know, working together, that's not necessarily something that we might call good. As somebody put it, it might mean, you know, replacing murder with genocide, in that the fact that a group works well together, it might simply mean it works well together to wipe out and destroy other groups. And of course, we have plenty of examples of that recently, as well, we always have plenty of examples of that. It's interesting because one of the implications here is that what holds people together, what holds individuals together as a group and makes them somewhat self-sacrificing is that there's an external threat. And so the interesting question, what happens when that external threat disappears? When the Soviet Union collapsed back in what, 1990, 91, there was a Soviet diplomat who talked to some Western diplomats and he said, you know, we're going to do something very terrible to you. We're going to deprive you of an enemy. Going to deprive you of an enemy. Wow. And I just wonder, I don't know that it's a coincidence. I don't think it's a coincidence that, you know, it was very soon after that, that if you'll excuse me saying this, I think the Republican Party started going crazy. You know, prior to that, Democrats and Republicans, they had to work together because there was this external threat as we understood it, right? But now, once there's not that external threat, then guess what? The kind of coalition in the U.S. And then pretty quickly, you got Newt Gingrich, right? The contract with America, et cetera, et cetera. So there's an important point here about how the external enemy is what binds the group together. I'm also struck by this basic orientation, how this responds to this age-old question about whether our human nature is basically good or selfish, right? It's interesting how that has been so important. We, you know, within, say, Europe, you think about, well, just to give a couple examples, Jean-Jacques Rousseau saying our nature is basically good until we're corrupted by civilization. Or on the other side, Thomas Hobbes talking about life being nasty, brutish, and short, unless you have some monarch to kind of control us. You get, by the way, the same debate within China in Confucianism. But maybe the answer that this points to is that both of these tendencies are there within us. And it's interesting how, if you go back to the earliest text of the Buddha, right, the Pali Canon, insofar as we have it, although there are some groups that'll talk about our essential nature being basically good, the Buddha never talks in those terms. He does talk about us having positive tendencies, propensities, and negative ones, and how important it is to, you know, diminish, minimize the negative, and to build and develop the positive ones. Okay, I hope that made sense, and I hope you're still with me. A lot more could be said about evolutionary psychology, you know, which is very controversial. It's like, how do you, this story makes a lot of sense to me, but how do you kind of prove it? Maybe it's just sort of like Kipling's just so stories. How do you, and again, I'm not sure, I don't know, but it's sort of, it seems to fit very well with a lot of different things. But here's the big question for me, moving on from there, can we understand our cultural evolution as in large part an attempt to deal with some of these problems created by our biological evolution, right? When you go back way, way back to hunting-gathering societies, it's interesting how, say, with what we sometimes call animism, that's really not preoccupied with good versus evil, right? It's more, you could say, a kind of sacrificing to the gods, some attempt to kind of control one's environment. Because hunting-gathering societies tend to be very small, and so the morality is very sort of personal there, right? So if you abuse my daughter, for example, you don't have to worry about the gods punishing you. You've got to worry about me and my brothers and my family. They're going to, so there's a kind of social reciprocal, control there just built into the society. But once you get agriculture, once you get large agricultural empires, it becomes quite different. And you're dealing with a much larger populations, and often people you don't know. And then interestingly, you tend to get what are sometimes called big gods, gods that are watching us, gods that are making sure we behave ourselves, and gods who can punish us if we don't, right? With these new kinds of agricultural societies, there's, well, let me mention a few things in particular. Once you're settled into agriculture, then the number one problem that develops, I think, is one that we have never found a solution for, which is to say classes, stratification. You know, as long as you were hunting and gathering, wealth isn't an issue. You know, you don't get really classes. You're nomadic, you move around, you can't really own very much. But once you're in one place, once you're building cities, then there's other possibilities, and you get very stratified societies, and you get civilizations, you get religion now is all about something that's used to maintain the harmony of that society, to make sure that people stay in their place. It's still in-group versus out-group. It's just now it's a really big in-group, maybe Mesopotamia against Egypt. And so if they go to war, it's also they're different gods. They have different gods. The gods go to war with each other. It's also important that the king is also the sort of head of the religion, or the head priest, the high priest. In other words, our distinction between secular and sacred doesn't exist. It just doesn't make sense in that kind of society. The person who's at the top of the society is there because he is also sort of the main one who communicates with the gods. He has the ultimate responsibility for relating to the sacred dimension. Okay, why am I going into that? Well, this is kind of what you got during the Bronze Age, which, you know, worked pretty well for quite a few centuries and then collapsed pretty dramatically beginning around the 12th century BCE, right? 11th, 12th century BCE. There was this breakdown all over the place in the Mediterranean. You know, virtually every major city collapsed, a few of them, or every major civilization collapsed. A few city-states, you know, reemerged, but you also had the main problem in India, the collapse of the Harappan, in China, the collapse of the Zhao. You had this huge collapse, and the kind of social chaos that went around, that went with that, was that people were looking for something new. And this is where we come to Buddhism. This is where we come to what are sometimes called the Axial Age religions, which include not only Buddhism in India, but the Abrahamic traditions. Perhaps the earliest was, although it's very hard with the dates here, Zoroastrianism in Persia, which had a huge influence on Judaism, you know, the earliest of the Abrahamic traditions. And this is what created a new kind of spiritual path, which it's our spiritual path. That's why it's really important to understand what's going on here. And it's interesting how so many of the major figures, they were people who sort of went off by themselves, you know. It's very different from, say, the old Mesopotamian or Egyptian, where the religion is also hierarchical with all these priests and so forth. You get these figures going off into the wilderness. You get Jesus, his 40 days and nights in the wilderness. You get the Buddha, the famous story of the Buddha, going off into the forest and you know, practicing with teachers, asceticism, and finally meditating by himself. So you get these individuals now who go off and they have these extraordinary experiences that transform them, and then they come back and they bring something quite new, a new kind of spirituality that emphasizes individual transformation and kind of universal ethics, universal compassion, right? Think, for example, in the Bible, the story of the Good Samaritan, right? Jesus tells that story in response to some expert in the law, right? The Torah, who said, you know, who is my neighbor? And he told this wonderful story. And one of the reasons it's so wonderful is that the Samaritan, right, he was not Jewish. They were related, but the Samaritan was a different group. And for the most part, Samaritans and Jewish people really didn't like each other. And so the fact that the Samaritan was the good guy of the story, it's pointing to the kind of universalism. You know, it's not just about our group versus your group. It's now a new kind of God, a new kind of spirituality that applies to everyone. And for the Buddha too, right? Think of the metta meditation, which there includes not only everyone, including our enemies, but also actually all sentient beings. It's this extraordinary development, which we tend to take for granted, that there's a kind of universalism here. Well, it wasn't a universalism before these Axial Age figures, right? But here's the catch, here's the problem. I think it's a big one. What perpetuated this universalism? Well, in the Abrahamic tradition, it's the fact that there's a God up there, a very big God, who has created everyone and is the God of everyone, and therefore is, as it were, telling us to behave ourselves or else, right? So if God wants us, you know, we better listen to what he wants us to do, or we're going to get in trouble. But what happens when we no longer believe in those gods? You see, it was the God that maintained that universalism. Likewise, in Buddhism, you can talk about the universal a law of karma. Yeah. Well, what if people don't believe in that kind of God as in the modern world? What if, in fact, people don't believe in the law of karma, right? What are we left with? The problem, you see, is that, let's use the example of Christianity, but I think to some extent, although Buddhism is more ambivalent, I think we can see the same thing operating there. By creating another reality, a God who has a heaven up there and a hell, and the possibility of an eternal bliss with this God, what does that do to this world, right? It tends to inevitably sort of devalue this world into a means to that ends, right? This becomes the place where the whole struggle of sin and karma, it's where that plays out. That cosmic drama plays out for us to qualify for somewhere better. In Buddhism too, how do we understand, or how did people understand nirvana in the Pure Land? How do they understand the Pure Land and what the possibilities are there, right? It seems to devalue this world into a kind of temporary home that in and of itself isn't all that important. It's something we use to get to somewhere better. So what happens later then, maybe in the modern era, when you get a science that doesn't seem to find any support for that other kind of reality, and therefore there's no religious spiritual authority sort of controlling good versus evil? What's going to happen there, you know, to the universalism? What's going to happen then to these tendencies? Again, these genetic tendencies built into us, you know, this struggle between greed, ill will, and delusion on the one side versus, you know, the more compassionate, empathic on the other side. What's going to happen to that? Sadly, because traditionally this other reality was the source, was not only the goal, but the source of all meaning and value and goodness, when that disappears, what we tend to be left with is a kind of devalued world here. And then we're faced with the struggle of, well, how do we revalue it? Do we fall into kind of a nihilism that sort of, again, opens the door to the exercise, again, of the three poisons, which frankly, I think both individually and collectively, I think we're seeing a lot of them. There's not any sort of spiritual supervision or control. People often don't believe in that. Okay, I hope that makes some sense. So what I've talked about so far is evolutionary psychology and kind of the evolution of religion, which in a way brings us to where we are now. And what I want to suggest, talk a little bit about how one might understand the traditional Axial Age teachings in a way that I think speaks more to our condition here. And a lot of what I have to say, I'm not sure it's going to be all that new, but I want to be clear about formulating it in this particular context, right? Let me start with two quotations. One of them is by the famous mythologist Joseph Campbell, who talked about how so often problems in religion happen because people take metaphors literally. This is what he said. Every religion is true one way or another, true when understood metaphorically. But when it gets stuck in its own metaphors, when it interprets them as facts, then you're in trouble. And there's another quotation from a New Testament theologian, John Dominic Crossan, which I find even more pointed. My point, he says, my point is not that those ancient people told literal stories and we are now smart enough to take them symbolically. But the opposite, they told them symbolically, and we are now dumb enough to take them literally. In other words, Maybe all this talk about another higher reality is really a misinterpretation, perhaps a misinterpretation by the founders themselves. Maybe one goes off into the forest by oneself and has this experience, and it seems, oh, some other reality, God here is speaking to me. Well, no, maybe it's just, you know, we today know how our usual way of experiencing the world is a psychological and social construct. So maybe what happened is this construct unraveled, or so that they could, in fact, experience this world differently. But maybe they took the point literally. They talked about another reality and missed the fact that what they could have been and maybe should have been talking about was the true nature, a different way of experiencing this world here and now, right? For example, at the core of Christianity, the story of the crucifixion and the resurrection of Jesus, right? As we know in our own tradition, how important it is, we can understand what's going on in our practice and in forgetting ourselves. You could say there's a kind of a, and it's usually not that easy. Usually we go through some dukkha, some hell, and in being able to do that. Maybe, as the Sufis like to say, the point is to die here and now so that when it's time for physical death, we're already dead, right? Maybe the death we all should be talking about is the death of the ego, and the kind of rebirth or resurrection is, you know, the kind that Dogen talked about, right? Body and mind falling away, leading to a different way, you know, the fallen away body and mind. In support of this, it's interesting, and don't quote me on this, but my understanding, you know, having read, is that when you go back in Christianity to the first of the Gospels to be written down, Mark, and you have to remember, none of them was written down for several decades. They're actually all anonymous, and none of the people who wrote them down had ever any personal encounter with Jesus. So it's all stories, right? It's interesting that the oldest version of Mark that we have, there's no virgin birth. Jesus is not the only son of God until his baptism. That's when he apparently becomes the son of God. And the oldest version of Mark, which is truncated, short, there's no resurrection, right? Again, trying to say, you know, trying to point to the idea here, let's return to the metaphors, how powerful it is if we understand death and rebirth in the Zen sense. Is this what we need to do in order to revive what I think are often very, you know, problematic, you know, axial traditions today? So that, you know, realizing our spiritual goal isn't about transcending or escaping this world, but realizing its true nature, realizing our non-duality with it. So the emphasis on personal transformation here and now, rather than qualifying for an eternal bliss with God after we die, or some kind of nibbana, parinirvana, then it becomes very clear that the spiritual path is really about self-transformation, and it's not, and like, again, I think as Buddhist practitioners, we know this, but I'm trying to put this in the context of where I think, you know, so many of our spiritual traditions have gone wrong. And the kind of transformation that we're looking for through our practice, there's the possibility of letting go of ourselves so that we experience the world differently here and now, right? Rather than trying to qualify for some eternity after we die, right? An important implication of this perspective is that I think something like this is necessary if we're going to be able to address the kinds of ecological and other social crises that I talked about at the beginning, right? The polycrisis, or rather the meta crisis, right? That we really need to radically transform ourselves in a way that recovers this fundamental message about, yes, self-transformation, in replacing, you know, the idea of somehow escaping from the world. What we need to escape, what we need to transcend, is not this world, but our usual way of experiencing it. Of course, part of the original attraction of these, of many of these actual age religions, is that they helped us deal with one of our most fundamental fears, which is to say death, right? And so in so many conventional religions, a lot of the attraction is because basically what they're saying is, hey, guess what? You don't really die. You know, and if you do what we tell you, then you're not only not going to die, but you're going to go somewhere much better. And it seems to me an important implication of what I'm talking about is something very important within our Zen tradition, something that we often emphasize, which is to say, don't know mind, that we don't know, you know, what death means. Personally, you know, traditional Buddhism talks a lot about cosmological karma and physical rebirth. Are they true? I don't know. I mean, many Buddhists would say, well, you have to believe in them if you're a Buddhist, but of course, there's no, it's really hard to tell. There's lots of interesting stories about children that seem to have memories that can't be explained other ways. But then again, from a scientific point of view, it's really hard to see how something like that could happen. And I think for me personally, it's important to sort of not to tie my spiritual path onto one or another belief, one side or the other, but simply acknowledge that there's a mystery here that I don't know. But in a way, and this is what's maybe more important, is actually it doesn't make any difference in terms of how I actually want to live right here and now. In either case, I want to do the very best that I can. And if there's such a thing as cosmological karma rebirth, then that'll should have some pretty good repercussions. But if there's not, well, in a sense, it doesn't make any difference. The other really important implication here is it naturally leads to the kind of ecological and social engagement that we so obviously need today, right? If we're not trying to escape this reality and devaluing this world, but if through our practice and through our personal transformation, we're come to experience it in a transformed way, in a more non-dual way, where we feel, where we realize our interdependence, then it seems to me that is exactly the kind of foundation we need for the kinds of engagement that we need today, right? You can say, the earth isn't only our home where we just happen to be living for a minute and maybe we can get an Elon Musk spaceship and go to Mars. I mean, the earth is our mother. We are, and we never cut that umbilical cord in the sense of, you know, our need for water, food, et cetera, et cetera. That we are one of the species whereby that mother nature, the earth is expressing it. And therefore this experience, I think this way, this alternative way of understanding, deliteralizing, you know, reviving the metaphorical understanding, I think it naturally ties into the kinds of social and ecological engagement that we need. That's not to say that it's a simple solution to the kind of meta crisis that we have. Obviously, no, in the sense that even if what I'm offering is exactly what's needed, I mean, how's that going to spread, right? How many people are going to want to do something like that? How does that vision compete with the other religious and especially the institutions of these religions that that are around? There's going to be a lot of resistance, and especially by, powerful people who basically have had the most to gain with the present system, who are often the ones most in the grip of greed, ill will, and delusion. And in any case, I think, frankly, what I'm suggesting, the kind of new religious paradigm, it's not going to avoid the kind of breakdown or even catastrophe that, things seem to be headed toward, even if we don't know what specific forms that may take. But it seems to me nonetheless that what I'm kind of pointing to in a very, very general sense could be understood as the kind of religion that I think we're going to need for the apocalyptic, for the end of time, to help us cope with what is happening, what already seems to have begun. So let me finish there, and I think it's worth mentioning, in a way, I don't know that I've said anything so radical from a Zen point of view. In a way, what I've tried to do is contextualize within a much broader vision of human history and religion the kind of thing that we're doing, and I think why it is so important that the Zen path that we are on is the way that it is. We're not trying to qualify for some thing after we die, but we are in fact doing what I think is absolutely necessary. And my hope is that in the future, it might be the case that other religions could also be reinterpreted in this more metaphysical way that emphasizes personal transformation. Okay, sorry, I've gone on quite a bit longer than I wanted, and I don't know whether this makes much sense, or it's just something that people might want to respond to.